Welcome to Managing in the Age of Transparency, the Puddle Fallacy. I'm Anne Mullaney. In this podcast, Cutter Consortium fellow Rob Austin talks about and tells stories of the impact that the once unimaginable volume of data that flows around the web can have on an organization and individuals. And he also offers advice to business technology leaders about how they can manage both the positive and negative consequences. If you don't know us yet, Cutter Consortium's a global technology advisory firm. We help organizations leverage emerging technologies and the latest business management thinking to achieve competitive advantage and mission success. Through consulting, research, training, and executive education, Cutter Consortium enables digital transformation. In addition to being a Cutter Consortium Fellow, Dr. Robert D. Austin is a professor of information systems at Ivy Business School and an affiliated faculty member at Harvard Medical School. Before his appointment at Ivy, he was a professor of innovation and digital transformation at Copenhagen Business School, and before that, a professor of technology and operations management at the Harvard Business School. At Harvard, Rob chaired the executive program for CIOs for more than 10 years. Before joining HBS, Rob was a technology manager at Ford Motor Company. He serves on the advisory boards of several IT industry firms and advises major corporations worldwide. Dr. Austin's research deals with IT management, specifically the management of knowledge-intensive activities with a particular focus on innovation. His most recent book is Harder Than I Thought, Adventures of a 21st Century Leader, which he co-authored with Cutter fellow Richard Nolan and Cutter consultant Shannon Hessel. Secrets leak, and stories go viral in the blink of an eye now that every employee carries a cloud-connected video recording device. Storage media have become practically undetectable. Smartphones, mass storage, and big data allow information to routinely and easily flow past traditional boundaries. This transparency can be positive. It might cause a thuggish political leader to think twice before committing atrocities in the age of ever-present smartphone-based video capture. But on the flip side, transparency makes protecting proprietary information a struggle. How can business technology leaders manage both the positive and negative consequences of radical transparency? In this podcast, Cutter fellow Rob Austin paints a picture of today's business landscape as it pertains to the control of information. Explore with Rob the new reality that may result from this changing terrain and discover what it could mean for your business strategy and operations. Enjoy the pod.
If I were going to sort of summarize in a sentence or two what I want to talk about today, it's that when information starts to flow around in new ways, in ways that it hasn't in the past, it changes things. I'm going to borrow Vince Kellen's phrase, hiding information is a fundamental human behavior. And when it becomes less possible, it changes a lot of things. It's a game changer. And so it's not only changes what you'll need to do as a manager and what your company will need to do, it also changes the way that people perceive what you do. And so customers, the public, may see something in a way that's entirely new because the information is flowing around in different ways. People get upset about new things. So for example, just to kind of give you a brief example, this happened in a narrow way in the music industry in the late 90s. So the music industry, their intellectual property, the bits and bytes that were their music catalog start to flow around in a new way. And you know, this was the age of Napster and illegal downloading and so forth. And not only did this ultimately force them to a new business model, right? So to the iTunes single song model, but it also surprised them because when they took legal action against the people who were illegally acquiring their intellectual property, they felt perfectly justified, right? But they found themselves on the wrong foot because suddenly people with the information flowing around and, you know, the information able to flow around via the web, they suddenly were seen as an obstacle to something that should happen, right? So, I mean, in the worst versions, they became viewed as the extortionists that were trying to get us to pay $20 for 12 songs when we only wanted one of them, right? So this is what I mean about people perceiving things in different ways. Okay, so let me jump into this. And to do this, I'm going to introduce you to Martha Payne. Now, Martha Payne, 9 years old in this story. This was 2012. Also known online as VEG. That means veritas ex gusto, means truth from tasting. And what's that about? Well, Martha saw something that offended her youthful sense of justice. She noticed that the descriptions of her school lunches, and she's in Western Scotland at this time, she noticed that the descriptions of her school lunches didn't match up very well with what appeared on her lunch plate. And so she decided she was going to create a blog, right, and have a screen name, and she was going to bring truth to tasting, or truth from tasting, to school lunches. And so she comes up with this idea with her dad's help. She's going to start a blog. It launched on April 30th, 2012. And on the very first day, she had a camera malfunction because her idea was she was going to take photos of her lunches every day and she was going to rate them and review them. What she's chosen to do on the first post, she's going to tell you how she's going to rate lunches. So there's the foodometer on a rank of 10, how great my lunch was, mouthfuls, portion size, how many courses, health rating, so some sense of how nutritional she thinks the food is. The price is always £2, but she lists it. And then I love the last one, and we're hoping it's always going to be zero, right? But it's pieces of hair. And she says, it won't happen, will it? Question mark, right? So, but we're going to see. So, starting the next day, she takes a photo of her lunch, and she says, this is my first pick. The pizza in the pick was all right, but I'd have enjoyed more than one croquette, right? I'm a growing kid, and I need to concentrate all afternoon. I can't do it on one croquette. Does anybody think you could, right? So the portion of the amount of the food becomes an issue right away. This is foodometer, 6 out of 10. Forgot to count however many mouthfuls. She gives it only a 4 out of 10 in terms of healthfulness and no pieces of hair, thankfully, right? So next day, that's what her next days are. Another lunch that same week looked like. Today's meal was on the menu as cheeseburger and ice cream biscuit, but as you can see, I got an ice lolly instead. She would have rather had the ice cream, right? Wish they had stuck to the menu. She did get 2 croquettes, but she didn't want the peas. She refused the peas, and they refused to give her extra cucumber to make up for the peas she didn't take, so she was upset about that. Foodometer, she liked this meal, 7 out of 10. Health rating, only 2 out of 10, still no pieces of hair, right? So that's good. Now, as you might imagine, there's a comment section on this blog, right? And so people start noticing and start commenting, and they start using some fairly provocative words, right? So that's a pathetic serving, according to the first one. Good blog, but that's not enough food, and it doesn't look very nutritious. Sophie on the 8th of May says, that's rubbish, right? And then the last one here, and this is just a selection, but they're not unrepresentative, says, that's disgraceful. How do you expect children to keep concentration in class, and so on? So we begin to see this kind of accumulation of words like pathetic, rubbish, disgraceful, and so forth. Without the hair, Jamie Oliver, and many of you will know Jamie Oliver, the celebrity British chef, he has made it his business to try to get school lunches to be more nutritious. And so he jumps on board this. He thinks this is a great initiative, says favorable things about it in the UK press, and the press covers it, right? So a 9-year-old girl won the support of celebrity chef Jamie Oliver. But you'll see again, some of those words are starting to pop in again, right? This one, this headline uses both dismal and miserable looking, right? 6 weeks later, 6 weeks after the launch, all this momentum gathered, right? And we get a post that says goodbye, right? And it says, this morning I got taken out of class by my head teacher and taken to her office. I was told that I could not take any more photos of my school dinners because of a headline in the newspaper today. Her dad weighs in, this is Veg's dad, Dave here. He says, you know, the school's been very good. I want anybody to be too upset about this. The decision was actually made by the local town council, the Argyle and Butte Council. It's a shame, though, because this blog by then, and especially riding the wave of publicity from Jamie Oliver, had had 2 million hits by then, right? And they had also, Martha had started to raise money for charity for kids in places where they don't get school lunches. And she'd already raised £2,000. But Dave, her dad, points out that they're going to have to stop that, too, since they're stopping the blog. Now, Almost immediately, we get in the next 24 hours 2,416 comments, right? And you know what they say, right? So, for example, I've been following your blog and I am livid. Write to the Argyle and Butte Council here to protest their decisions. There's a petition, right? There is, of course, there's a hashtag that begins to trend, et cetera, et cetera. And note that these are all from the 15th of June. The blog was shut down on the 14th of June. The press immediately picks it up. I mean, one of the things that I think is quite striking, and this is good, right? Illiberal Scottish council silences 9-year-old girl. So successful has this blog been that it received over 2 million hits, more than this blog has received in 3 years. And interestingly, Wired Magazine, and this is like 8 time zones away, right? On the other side of the world, Wired Magazine and put something up, says 9-year-old who changed school lunches, silenced by politicians. Note, this is the same day, aided by time zones, right? Because it's earlier in California than it is in Scotland. Very same day, 9:02 p.m., that she posts her blog that says goodbye. So happening extremely rapidly. And 9:02 p.m. the same day, Never Seconds blogger Martha Payne, school dinner photo ban lifted. 15th of June, the very next day. And the poor town council, right? Controversial ban preventing 9-year-old girl from photographing her school meals has been lifted following a storm of protest on the internet. In the 24 hours, they've had another million hits. And, you know, the poor town council, they release a statement that says, we were just trying to protect the feelings of the cafeteria workers. But nobody's buying, right? But, I mean, the point here is there's this entirely new community that is celebrating this that didn't exist 24 hours before, really. I mean, they kind of existed in the sense that they were supporters of the blog all along, but they were kind of crystallized and materialized by this cause that appeared. They accomplished something very quickly and remain. And, of course, this is a very happy ending. Martha, you know, her Never Seconds blog is listed on top 25 list for the year. She actually ends up on TV with Jamie Oliver. She ends up visiting some of the places where her charity is paying for cafeterias and school lunches and so forth. So generally an all-around success story. But not a story that I think is too different in some ways than stories that we see now, right? And so a question I would suggest at this point is, what happened here? And if we take the organization's perspective, what did they get wrong when they ordered Martha to stop blogging about her school lunches? What did they get wrong? So they made some assumptions about what was going to happen with the information about their actions. And that's the thing I would like to focus on here. So this is a photograph of something that I think we all probably have experience with. And there are certain things you can observe of puddles. Based on our longtime experience from childhood, we know things about puddles, right? We know, for example, that you can move water between puddles, but it doesn't move by itself, right? So you could scrape like a channel between two of these puddles and use that to combine the water. You could take a cup or a bucket, you could scoop some water out of one of the puddles and you could pour it in. But generally speaking, the behavior of water in puddles is kind of like, it like echoes a Newtonian law of physics, right? Water in puddles tends to remain in puddles unless somebody does something to alter that, right? So we have this kind of instinctive belief about water in puddles. And I would suggest to you that, you know, our Argyle and Butte Council, and I think to an extent, many people everywhere in the world may have some of these reflexive beliefs about information as well. Because it was not so long ago that information behaved in this way, that it remained, it could be expected to be known and to be reacted to and so forth in roughly the vicinity where it occurred, right? So it didn't used to be such an unusual or unreasonable assumption that if the Argyle and Butte Council did something, that it would primarily matter in Argyle and Butte, and that someone in California wouldn't react to it within 24 hours, right? That's a fairly new behavior. So if we start to think about, you know, what is it exactly that's caused this? Because when this starts to happen, you know, people start to get surprised. Somebody starts to have a new problem. The Argyle and Bute Council suddenly has a problem. And you guys know the story. You used the word going viral. Probably some of you saw this recording of somebody called Comcast and talked to a customer service representative that was extremely interesting, right? That ends up on going viral. I don't have to tell you how many police departments have problems like this, right, these days. And I mean, I'll show you one later where the Austin Police Department, Austin, Texas, 26-year-old college student jogging, has earbuds in her head and doesn't hear the police officer tell her she shouldn't jaywalk. She does it anyway. And the police officer grabs her from behind, and, 26-year-old woman, jogging shorts, dressed for exercise, gets grabbed from behind. What do you think she does? Whack, right? She swings at the guy, and the next thing you know, she's down on the ground. There's six police officers there, right? And all of it captured on camera, on a cell phone. So what is it that happens that has caused this? And one of the things that I think we have to observe immediately is that our puddles have massively overflown, right? One of the things that's happened is that the sheer amount of information that we're talking about has increased. And that when puddles turn into floods, they stop being well-behaved. They stop observing boundaries, right? So the stop sign says stop, but the flood isn't going to pay any attention to that. And so if we kind of look at how we've gone from what is essentially kind of a data desert with a few puddles to a world where we have a data flood, I mean, the evidence is everywhere. This is from Cisco. 6.3 million megabytes moving around every month. That's a per month number. 70% of all digital data is created by consumers. So that's pretty new too, right? Is that we all carry a machine around with us, at least one machine, maybe more, that is capturing digital data and that is sending it or capable of transmitting it out into a cloud. And so what this is telling us is that the vast majority of digital data that's out there, we are producing ourselves, right? So it's not coming from official sources or news agencies or whatever. We're also seeing more location-tagged data. Expected increases are big. There's lots of video and photos stored by Facebook per user, 111 megabytes per person of video about our lives that's out there. So what does this mean? Well, we've gone from a world where there were well-behaved, controllable flows, where we could assume stable boundaries between puddles, and where boundaries were easy to construct. And we've moved to a world where there are unpredictable, uncontrollable flows, where boundaries overflow in ways that are not necessarily predictable and expected, and also where pressure is building behind our constructed levees. And we've actually invested a lot of money in our organizations in constructing boundaries for our information. But the pressure has never been higher, and it's getting higher, and there is greater threat of overflow. One way to think about this is that, if you think about channels of information flow, not only are these devices sources of data, they are also the inputs of entirely new channels of data flow. So somebody takes a photo of a key screen in one of your systems and then uses the 3G or 4G technology to move it to the cloud, that doesn't traverse any of the boundaries that you've constructed for yourself, right? It kind of routes around them. So there are all these, there's a proliferation of channels of data flow that's happening as well. One of the things that this raises the specter of is that there are people out there who know things about you that you don't know that they know, right? So whether you're an individual, and I'm mostly talking about companies here, somewhere in your organization, someone blogged about an outage. Somewhere in your organization, someone tweeted about not having anything to do right now because the company's having this and such a problem. None of that traverses your firewall. It all goes kind of around. So what do they know? What do they know about you personally and your organization? Some interesting questions. Who knows more about you and your organization than you do? Because this is something that would be nice to know if you're a leader of an organization. Is there somebody out there that knows something that's going to surprise you when they bring it to light? And, you know, this is kind of the, this is some famous examples of this in the big data discussions. By putting two and two together, they can learn even more about you by cross-referencing data sets and so on. So everybody probably knows the stories about, you know, for example, Target that started sending mailings to a guy's daughter about diapers and things like that. And he went to Target and said, "Why are you sending these things to my 16-year-old daughter?" And it turned out she was pregnant and Target knew before he did, right? Because of her web searches and because they were analyzing. So there's lots of what you can learn by putting two and two together. One of the things they discovered in the data.org project that's been running for years now is, this is from a computer scientist, he discovered if you took one data set that's freely available and seems to have no privacy or national security content, and cross-reference it with another data set that seems to have no privacy or national security content, you can figure out the key places to take out to take down the electric grid in North America. So these kinds of things people can learn by putting two and two together. This one's kind of fun. This hotel in New York City got a really bright idea. They didn't like negative Yelp reviews, especially from wedding parties. And so they took a deposit from the wedding couple. And they said, "You have to tell all your guests not to put negative reviews on Yelp, because if you do, we're going to deduct $500 from your wedding deposit," right? And so they thought this was going to be a good idea. So unsurprisingly, by now, and this is, you know, this is a contract you signed if you wanted to have your reception or whatever at this hotel, if you wanted to have people there for your wedding. Unsurprisingly, now the Yelp page for the Union Street Guesthouse is inundated with outraged one-star reviews, right? The hotel that was fined wedding guests for bad reviews was probably breaking the law. But it's interesting. Why again? This is kind of like, what was Argyle and Bute Council thinking? Why do you think they thought they could do this? Well, because they thought the information was going to stay in the puddle. And so, you know, one of the questions that I'm trying to implicitly raise here is, you know, which puddles are you assuming? And there are lots of puddles for a lot of different reasons. So, for example, you know, one of the things that's kept information in puddles is language. So if something happens or an editorial happens in, I'll just use the example of the country I'm from, if it happens in Danish, you kind of assume that it's not going to be known very much in San Francisco. You know, Google Translate's working on that one, right? It won't be very long until that one won't be much of a barrier anymore, but it's going to surprise some people when it happens. So one of the things that I would suggest is changing, is changing even more, is that the permeability of assumed information barriers has dramatically increased. Information more often leaks past natural barriers. And we still, I mean, this is one of the things we should all sort of search our psyches for, is what natural barriers are we assuming for information about our companies, about ourselves, and so forth. And so ask the Argyle and Bute Town Council, the Austin, Texas Police Department I mentioned before, the Union Street Guesthouse. So I like to call this the puddle fallacy, right? People like to say what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Not anymore, right? Yeah, that's the puddle fallacy. So what happens in Vegas is probably going to be in the cloud, right? If it's got some sort of informational value. So, but there's also the constructed barriers, like the firewalls and so forth. They are also becoming more permeable. It's getting harder to contain information. It more often leaks past intentional barriers. I just got a couple of pictures here. That's a micro SD card. It's about the size of your fingertip. 128 gigabytes is the current max capacity of something the size of your fingertip. So maybe you've got really great security procedures in your company, but can you really be sure somebody couldn't get something out that's the size of your fingertip? This isn't the actual flash drive or USB drive, but it's a sort of a staged mock-up of the one that Snowden walked out of the National Security Agency with 1.7 million classified documents with, right? So walked right past. I assume the National Security Agency would have pretty good policy procedures and so on, but somehow that happened. This is something, this isn't even particularly new anymore. This is, when I took this photo, it was probably a year and a half ago, and I was at the Brookstone at Boston Logan Airport. This is a pin with a secret. Looks very much like a pin, but it's a high-definition video camera. right? And you can see, you just pop it apart, you load it on, stick it in your USB port, download it to your computer, and then if you, you know, either walk out with your computer or you, if you can, in your organization, you send it out through the cloud. You may think you can, I mean, you may not even know about something like that, but I mean, another thing that is kind of fun these days is, you know, people are starting to wear watches. So, and I don't say, you know, I'm not suggesting that these are not things that you can not, I mean, you can deal with some of these things individually. The problem is, to really deal with the overall problem, you have to be able to think of every route out of the organization, right? And that's, I think that's the real problem, is that these devices and all of their, you know, their colleagues, if you like, the portable, personal, digital capture devices and transmission devices are proliferating very dramatically, and they're all connected to transmission modes that are not the ones that we've been trying to protect for some time. The most serious threats, many of them are low tech, right? I mean, so some of the things that happen that cause data breaches are not because the people at the other end of the wire are extremely sophisticated technically. It's because they're, you know, today's version of a con man. A whole new group of, and again, many of you will know about this, but there are a whole new group of activists out there that are using their computer skills with agendas. You know, they're trying to promote agendas. And I've got a little excerpt of one of their announcements, if you like, one of their demand notices, right? And this one goes with a story. There's a young, and it's actually quite a tragic story. There's a teenage girl in Nova Scotia, and she, you know, this is actually something that is a bit of a problem. It's happened several times in, had been in the news, but she ends up with a group of guys. She drinks too much. Then there's sex, and then there are claims that she's been taken advantage of. Then there are also claims that she was a consensual partner in the sex, but she's really too young to consent legally and so on. So the police investigate, and they end up in this case deciding that there's no as often happens, in fact, that there's no case to press, that they call it a he said, she said, right? So they dismiss the charges in this case. And then Retea Parsons is the name of the girl. She killed herself after this happened. She was being, not only did this happen, they recorded it on social media, they distributed it to everybody in the high school, and they did what's, we now have a word for this in our lexicon, it's called slut shaming, right? So they slut shamed her to a point where she killed herself at 15 or something like that. And the police, again, claim, you know, there's really kind of nothing they can do. So in this particular case, and this has become the, what's interesting about this has become a common practice, is that people on the are tweeting to this organization. We'll talk more about, it's not really an organization, this group called Anonymous, and they're saying, the police have given up, please come help. And it's kind of like, you know, like the bat signal or something, right? So you know, in the comic books, when the police couldn't get you satisfaction, you called for the vigilante Batman by putting a light in the sky that had a bat symbol on it. And so that's what they did here on this particular day when the police announced that they would be pursuing nothing further about this. And by 9:30 that night, this announcement came back in response to all the calls for Anonymous to come to the rescue.
This is a statement from Anonymous. We engaged Hope Justice for Retea this morning in response to the suicide of Retea Parsons. Justice Minister Ross Lamby says that it is important for Nova Scotians to have faith in their justice system. Mr. Lamby, justice is in your hands. We can confirm the identities of two of the four alleged rapists. We are currently confirming a third, and it is only a matter of time before the fourth is identified as well. Our demands are simple. We want the ends. RCMP to take immediate legal action against the individuals in question. We encourage you to act fast. If we were able to locate these boys within 2 hours, it will not be long before someone else finds them. We do not approve of vigilante justice as the media claims. That would mean we approve of violent actions against these rapists at the hands of an unruly mob. What we want is justice. And that's your job. So do it. The names of the rapists will be kept until it is apparent you have no intention of providing justice to Rita's family. Please be aware that there are other groups of anonymous also attempting to uncover this information and they may not to wish to wait at all. Better act fast. Be aware that we will be organizing large demonstrations outside of your headquarters. The rapists will be held accountable for their actions. You will be held accountable for your failure to act. We are anonymous. We are legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
So you can see they have a flair for drama. So what happened? Next day, the RCMP reopened the case, right? In response, so this is a situation where the hacktivists, now they went out of their way to say that an important new source of information appeared, but it was not an online source, they said. So, and maybe it wasn't, right? And one of the things that, you know, has been speculated about is that sometimes these hacktivists make known information that the authorities have, but don't think that they can use or haven't been inclined to use. And now that they are known by others, they have to be used. So it may be true that the information didn't come from an online source, but it may also still be possible that the pressure from this kind of online activity caused them to change their mind about what they were going to do. Ultimately, two of the boys were charged and they were convicted. There was a settlement. Unfortunately, they were not charged of sexual assault. They were, it's a legal process, so I don't know what happened. But one of them was a misdemeanor charge, and the other was convicted of distributing child pornography because she wasn't of age when they took the photos and transmitted them. So some people would say not an entirely satisfactory outcome. So one of the things that, you know, this points out is that there are people out there who kind of, and, you know, in this case, you can say, you know, it's a cause that you, I mean, you can be quite, I feel kind of happy that they reopened the case, right, as a result of this action. So it seems like, in a way, this is kind of like Batman. He's kind of actually a good guy, right? The next example may not change your mind. This one shows that this isn't kind of, just because probably these guys are 16 or 19 years old, doesn't mean it's not something you should worry about. So H.B. Gary is a consultant, a digital security consultant to the U.S. Defense Department and to the U.S. Intelligence Services, right? And so they sell their services. This is here, leading provider of innovative technologies and solutions for mission-critical national security programs for the intelligence community, the Departments of Defense, State, Homeland Security, Energy, and Justice, including the FBI, the health and space communities, and other federal government customers. So the head of the federal division, which is the division that sells to those government organizations, a guy named Aaron Barr, this is the CEO, he decided that he was going to try to make his customers happy by doing a little work on their behalf. And so there was a group of anonymous hackers who remained at large. They were guilty of shutting down processing at MasterCard and Visa, and also raiding Senator Joe Lieberman's office and shutting them down and so forth. And what they were upset about is that MasterCard and Visa had stopped processing donations for WikiLeaks. And so Joe Lieberman they were upset with him because he's the one who had gone to MasterCard and Visa and said, please stop processing donations for WikiLeaks. So they were kind of, again, there's a cause here. And so Aaron Barr decided he was going to find out who these guys were. You know, we got digital security skills. They went out there. They were posing as people interested in joining Anonymous out on the web. And so he felt that he was making some progress. And the idea he had is he's going to take this prize back to his clients. And, you know, I assume this was going to get them more business ultimately. It was going to make their customers happy anyway. But he made a mistake. He talked to the Financial Times about what he was doing. He gave an interview to the Financial Times where he suggested that he was closing in on his prey. There's a very nice account on Ars Technica of exactly how Anonymous pulled this off. And this is the point, this is the one I referred to earlier. At the heart of it was a social engineering maneuver, right? Where they actually convinced the chief technology officer, I think it was, to give up a password. They pretended they were Barr, you know, that they were communicating via messaging. So again, you know, none of this would have been possible without a key break that came with social engineering. But, you know, the main point here, of course, and it's pretty obvious, is that if they can do it to H.B. Gary that sells services to the intelligence agencies and the Defense Department. And it turns out these guys, there were five of them. They have ultimately been caught. The FBI caught them by catching one of them and then using him to catch the others. So they have been caught. They were 28, 23, two of them were 19, and the last one was 16. Right, and so some of them have been received some prosecution and penalties, but some of them have not. I mean, they're not quite sure what to do with the 16-year-old, for example, right? So anyway, so these are, again, you know, both of these stories, the Rattaya Parsons story and the H.B. Gary story, have, at least in my sentiments, I'm kind of like, yeah, these are the good guys, right? These H.B., these Anonymous guys. But they're not always good. Some of you may remember, this was not very long ago, there was a very big outage. Anything that the Boston area hospitals had connected to the internet went out. And it was because there was a case, and I'm not going to probably get all the details right, but there was a case of a young woman whose parents brought her in claiming that she had a rare genetic disorder. The doctors looked her over, couldn't figure out what was wrong with her, ultimately decided that it was a case of what they call Munchausen's by proxy, that her parents were actually, or one of her parents was actually causing the sickness by poisoning her or something like that. So they took her away, and privacy regulations are such that the hospitals couldn't say anything about it, but the parents could say plenty about it. So they were out in the news, and Anonymous formed around the cause of this injustice, taking this young girl away from her parents. Anonymous decided they were going to take down the healthcare facility where the young girl was being housed, but they didn't know the IP address range, so they targeted wide, and they basically took down all of the Boston area hospitals. The Anonymous guys, these are the good guys, right? And well, not always, right? And there have been other cases where they've done what you saw in the previous example of releasing the names of alleged perpetrators and gotten them wrong. Right, so you get the names wrong, you release the wrong identity, and so forth. So generally speaking, you can like these guys sometimes, but there are other times you can't really. Also, it's not really an organization, as I said. It's a fluid membership. It, like the community in support of Martha Payne's blog, it coalesces around a cause, right? And then it disperses again. Mostly they do get caught eventually, but that doesn't keep other people from participating. If you add on into all of this, and I won't spend much time on this because I think there's plenty of people who will talk to you about this, they're also quite organized people, right? So having made the point that it doesn't require anything more than 16-year-olds who are pretty good with low-tech measures, there are also people out there who are quite sophisticated working on getting into your organizations, right? And this is an example of organized crime. They recruit some of your employees. This guy is going to offer a Ferrari. He's going to give a Ferrari to the hacker that dreams up the biggest scam. But they're also, as you know, foreign governments. Maybe there's no particular reason they'd be interested in you. But in fact, in some ways, they're more understandable, right? One of the ominous things about these kinds of people, though, is that when they figure out something they can do against you, they don't brag about it like hackers used to. They just keep it secret so they can do it again. Anyway, I won't spend much time on that one because you can find lots of digital security consultants to talk about that. I want to keep the framing at the larger issue of the fact that things are becoming more transparent. Dan Geer is one of the, I think, foremost thinkers about digital security in the world. And if you haven't seen a video or a text, he's got a text version of it, a speech he gave at the RSA conference in February of 2014. Check it out, because it's called We Are All Intelligence Officers Now. And he talks about the fact that there's really no anonymity anymore, that we all produce individually and as organizations what he calls digital exhaust, and that we're all uniquely identifiable as part of it. So Dan is a very careful guy. One of the things that he will do is he said, because I don't like to identify myself when I call people, I turn off the thing on my cell phone that sends the number out. And he said, but ironically, whenever someone in my family gets a call from me, they know it's me because I'm the only one that turns that feature off, right? So, I mean, his point is you can't opt out of this because someone else will identify you if you don't. If you haven't identified your face on Facebook, someone else has taken a photo of you and tagged it as you. So that's the database, and facial recognition is pretty good. And as he points out, too, your heartbeat rhythm uniquely identifies you. The accelerometer in your telephone can measure your gait, and that uniquely, your walking pattern, and that uniquely identifies you. Your smell identifies you, believe it or not, and can be detected automatically. So who you are is not too hard to figure out. And you know, this begins to verge on the government surveillance kind of a thing, and I want to steer clear of that as well, because part of my point here is it's not only the government that can see things. Right, the overall situation with respect to transparency is becoming changed. This is an example of one of the ways, and this is again, I bring this up because it's relatively low tech. And the next two examples are relatively low tech. This is the government of Iran. Government of Iran didn't like some demonstrators that decided to go demonstrating and decided to try to identify them by taking photos from surveillance cameras and posting them to the web and then offering rewards for people who would identify the people in the photos. Now, Jonathan Zittrain, he did a little experiment where he said, suppose you use something like a crowdsourcing approach, like Amazon Mechanical Turk, and you paid somebody to compare photos and gave them a small amount each time they looked at one. And so if you've got this number of photos and you've got the database from the equivalent of the Iranian DMV, so you've got all everybody who drives, you've got their photograph, and you ask people to manually compare them and you pay them maybe, I don't know, 10 cents for each one, he calculated that it would take about 3 days and about $16,000 to identify everybody up here just using that approach, assuming that you couldn't do it in an automated manner, that you needed people to do the pattern recognition on that. So that's one. This one, some of you may know. Now, Dusty the Cat, a YouTube video posted in 2010 to YouTube. It's a guy, he's wearing a ski mask to hide his identity, and he's doing terrible things to a cat, right? So he's torturing a cat on YouTube. An entire group of cat sympathizers comes together, you know, galvanized by the cause, and they began to do various kinds of analysis. This is the crowd, right? The crowd is coming to the rescue of Dusty the cat. They're comparing the Dusty the cat video to YouTube other YouTube videos, also to Facebook photos and so forth. And within about 24 hours, they had identified the cat abuser as a guy named Kenny Glenn. And they had notified the authorities, and the authorities had gone out to Kenny Glenn's house and arrested him for abusing animals, right? So these are not professionals, right? But they, you can see what they did. They did, you know, it's almost like what you might see in, you know, that show, Crime Scene Investigation or whatever, that this is the power of what is basically a low-tech factor, the crowd. If you can get enough interested people mobilized, comparing notes, discussing things, that they can figure out things about you that you might not like them. You might not have disclosed yourself, let's just put it that way. So certainly Kenny Glenn wasn't looking to get identified. He was wearing a ski mask and he thought that was enough, but it was not. Some other things that we can think about changed and changing. Information permanence. This is that thing we were talking about a little bit before. You could try to get rid of information on the internet. They call this the Streisand effect. What happened is Barbara Streisand, her house was photographed in an aerial survey. And then somebody on the internet figured out which house was hers and labeled it. You know, they took a copy of the aerial survey photo and then posted it and labeled Barbara Streisand's house. Well, she hired lawyers to get it taken down. But every time her lawyers succeeded in having it taken down, it appeared 10 other places on the internet, right? Because there are people out there determined not to let this happen, just as a matter of principle. Another example, In 2007, HD DVD players on the market released with a DRM system that could be hacked if you entered this hex sequence. What it would do is it would defeat the region coding. Being an American who lives in Denmark, I hate region coding, right? You have to have the DVDs from the right continent or it won't play in your DVD player. So they posted it on the web. And again, the companies that had manufactured the equipment tried to get it taken down legally. Did not work because every time you eliminate one, 10 more at least appear. So this is the Streisand effect. Pretty much anything you try to get taken down, you're not necessarily going to succeed. It's not going to be that you're not going to legally succeed. You're just not going to practically succeed, right? So I heard Eric Schmidt, the chairman of Google, say not too long ago, you should have a conversation with your kids about this because anything they put out there is pretty much there forever, right? You also can't turn it off. The former Turkish prime minister had a conversation with his son on the telephone that someone recorded, I think illegally. And it sounds on the recording like they're talking about a bribe or something. It sounds suspicious and, you know, nobody really knows what they were talking about. But what the prime minister found is he could convince the local media not to publish stories about this, but he couldn't seem to stop Twitter and Facebook and social media. So he decides, and the expression he used was interesting. He said, "I will rip Twitter's roots out." Right, that's what he said in a speech. And he tried. He banned Twitter March 21st, this is last year, at 3:16 a.m. But by 11 a.m., it was bypassed, right? So users bypassed Turkey's Twitter ban. Their efforts to block Twitter and head off a stream of corruption allegations appeared to have failed after the Turks used technical means to circumvent the ban. Twitter helped, right? They said you can send tweets using SMS. So... And this is not a unique story. I mean, a lot of the sort of Tunisian uprising and so forth, there were various efforts to block social media, and they were generally worked around, often by groups like Anonymous were organized to work around them. The Hong Kong protests, they were worried about cell phone towers being shut down because they were using cell phones to coordinate a lot of their protest activities. And so they started to use, I think it's called FastChat. It's an application that creates a mesh network. It's kind of a relay. So it goes phone to phone to phone until it can reach a cell phone tower that's turned on. So doesn't actually require a cell phone tower to be turned on anywhere near it. So now they didn't actually have that problem, but they were ready if they had it. So what are the business implications here? I think there are many, but some have to do with how see-through that the companies have become and you know the supply chains have become. Now, there are companies that have complained that it's no longer possible for them to fully know what their supply chain contains and what's going on in it. But the problem is, there are people out there looking for what's going on in your supply chain, and there's new visibility into it that arises, you know, because of these kinds of devices. There are YouTube videos that can appear. There are people inside the supply chain itself who can send messages and so on. And, you know, of course, transparency is often a word that we think of with favorable connotations, right? So if this results in improvements, then maybe we like this. Certainly, you got to figure that if you're sort of a thuggish dictator somewhere contemplating sending the army out against citizens, probably these days you're going to think about what that might look like on YouTube, right? And that's hard to think that that's a bad thing. But it is also true of our various companies. How do you manage your image? Well, one of the things that you may have to think about is, you know, there may be people that you've historically just been shutting out, but there's a question about whether you can shut them out anymore. And so maybe this argues for some preemptive engagement with people who you might not like to deal with much. It might argue for a different approach to your communications and public relations. Here's, a pretty big one. Can you afford to rely on business strategies that depend on keeping secrets? In some ways, competition is about It's about information hiding. So the information I have that I keep hidden is the basis for my competition. It also depends on execution, what you're able to do. And that there are certainly companies out there that compete based on execution that don't really have any proprietary advantage over their other companies. But there are plenty of companies that do have proprietary advantages and do have secrets they need to keep. This isn't to say that it will be impossible, but it becomes increasingly expensive. Part of the economic statement of this problem is that it's getting really cheap for the people who are trying to find out things to find out things, and it's getting really expensive for you to keep them from doing it. So it doesn't mean it's impossible, but it does mean it's going to be expensive. So this puts us in a tough spot, I think. Also, the thing we talked about before, where the rules that apply to us are not the rules that apply to the people who are often trying to get the information. So there's an asymmetry there that's disturbing. This is, I think, perhaps the biggest deal, and also the least intuitive, that there are things that won't work in a super transparent environment that have always worked. So we had a guy, David and I were at a conference in Brussels, and we were giving a version of this talk, and we had a guy come up to us afterwards, and he said, you know, we've had a problem like this. He said, we used to, and there was a software company, he was a software company or some kind of company that was selling something, and he said, we used to give new customers discounts. We'd say, you know, 50% off for the first year or something like that. And he said, we've discovered we can't do that anymore because our existing customers find out. And then they demand the same discounts, right? Or else they're angry. And so one of the things that the sort of general principle here is, and I mentioned it at the outset, when information starts flowing around in new ways, what people think is fair and reasonable changes, right? And this is a good example is what happened in the music industry that, you know, in a way, the music industry was just protecting their own property, something we considered completely reasonable for a while in history. But once bits and bytes can flow around freely, and once we get the idea of how easy it is to move music around, it starts to seem unreasonable of the music companies to prevent that. And so they were kind of caught on the wrong foot. And so this is the final point that I want to make. And this is the one that, as I say, it's probably the most important. And Charlie Nesson, who is a law school professor at Harvard, he, back in the Napster era, he used to come to my class at Harvard and he would download music illegally during class, right? And one day he was downloading it illegally and he got interdicted. You know, they used to be able to hire these companies that would attack you when you started to illegally download music. So musicians would hire people to attack people who were illegally downloading their music. And so he got attacked during class. I always wondered if he staged it. But he said he didn't. And I used to tell him, I'm still waiting for you to get a subpoena during class, right? Or something like that. But one of the things that he pointed out is that we establish intellectual property laws, for example, that there are the practical considerations and then there are the legalities. And so one of the things that makes intellectual property work, the idea that, let's just take books, that we can't copy books in mass or anything like that, is that it's actually kind of hard to copy books, right? You have to stand at the printer and turn the pages, and then you look at it, now that one turned out smudgy, I have to redo it, and so forth. And so he said in the earlier era, when books were on the page, the practicalities aligned with the legalities. We weren't supposed to copy books, and it was physically difficult to copy books, right? He said, when those things get out of alignment, though, people's sense of fairness starts to get all different, too, right? So once it becomes easy, once it's in bits and bytes, and it starts to be easier to move bits and bytes around, then people's sense of what is fair changes, and we get people, you know, a fair number of people thinking the record companies are the bad guys for trying to protect their property. Now, my main point, the point I want to leave you with today, is that this is a much wider, this phenomenon has become much wider. It's no longer just a particular industry's property in bit and byte format that's flowing around and changing the public and our and consumers' ideas about what fair is. It's now the contents of our lives, right? It's the contents of our personal lives, of our organizational lives, and so forth, as captured by these devices, by, you know, HD pins that sit in people's pockets, by watches that connect to the internet, by LiveScribe digital pins, and so forth. In the era of wearables, one can only assume that the number of endpoints for digital channels will proliferate. So my suggestion, and you know, ask me in 2 years what things are working, because I think we really haven't quite adjusted to this yet. If you think about it, if you search your psyche and your organization's psyche, a lot of people are still assuming that some information can be kept in puddles. And as I say, maybe some of it can, but it's going to be expensive. So my recommendation at the end would be to look over what you're doing, to think about not only what you're doing that might have to change, but also how you need to be ready for people to catch you on the wrong foot. Something's going to surprise you. Something you think is quite reasonable that you've been doing for a long time is going to suddenly become viewed in a different way. It may be because somebody ripples a false claim through the internet or the web or whatever, but it's going to happen. And I think if you might as well start thinking about it.
We hope you enjoyed this Cutter Consortium podcast, Managing in the Age of Transparency, the Puddle Fallacy. If you have any questions, you can email us at service@cutter.com or contact us via Twitter. We're at CutterTweets. For links to some of the resources Rob Austin referenced in this podcast, visit www.cutter.com/puddles. Cutter.com/puddles. And please subscribe to our feed for upcoming podcasts by Cutter Consortium's experts.